Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. This month marked the 100th anniversary of the official entry of the United States into the First World War. The U.S. had been fighting wars along the Mexico border and earlier in Cuba, but it took World War I to turn the United States into the global military power it has become.
One of the key figures to do that was General John Blackjack Pershing. He was the supreme commander of U.S. forces in Europe at the time, and to this day is the only general to receive 6 stars rather than 5. A new book, My Fellow Soldiers, looks at the legacy of Pershing and other famous and not-so-famous Americans who helped win the Great War. Author Andrew Carroll will be in Milwaukee this weekend, but he joins us by phone first from his office in Washington, D.C.
I really think the story tells itself, and that's what drew me into it, because like many people, I wasn't really that fascinated in World War One. I run this project to preserve American letters, and we go from the Revolution all the way through up to Iraq and Afghanistan. So we cover letters from World War One, but they never kind of pulled me in the way that other conflicts had, especially World War Two. But once I learned more about Pershing in particular and his backstory, where, you know, he's seen as kind of this statuesque figure. I mean, you just look at the picture on the cover. And
he's stunningly handsome.
Yeah, and he looks like a man of steel. Like,
yep.
He looks really tough. But behind the scenes, and I didn't know this story, during the war, but before America got involved, this is in 1915, so he was in Texas at the time, he found out that his family, who was living at the Presidio, his wife and his 3 daughters, all died in one night in a house fire. And only his little boy, Warren, was pulled out alive. And he wrote these incredible letters to his friends and to other relatives about his grief and the loss. And it suddenly, when I came across these, like, really humanized him. And it made me want to learn more about who this individual was, who I think, I didn't know this at the time, a lot of people don't know, is the highest-ranking general in American history. He's the only general who, in his lifetime, was essentially given a 6th star for his service. And so, you know, he eclipses all these other generals that have kind of, I think, overshadowed him, like, you know, Patton and MacArthur and Eisenhower. So that in itself made me want to learn more about him. And, of course, as I learned, you know, his personal story, I learned more about the war and how he led it and how he was really brought in when America was not a major power. And so he really kind of had to build this army that went off to help the Allies win victory. And so that's why the book is very much not just about him, but about these other Americans, whether they're ambulance drivers or nurses or soldiers. And I really even follow the first Americans who volunteered even before America got involved. And this is back in 1914, 1915. So you have these young pilots and these young men who joined the French Foreign Legion and these women who were driving ambulances in actually pretty dangerous areas. And their story just became so compelling to me, and I wanted to tell it through their own words. So, you know, it's a nonfiction book, and I would like to think it reads kind of like a novel. But everything is true. Everything that's said is, you know, from actual sources, from journals, from letters and diaries. And it really, I think, gave me a much better sense of the sacrifices that these men and women made. The thing that also really struck me is that they were fighting a war in principle. America was not attacked. There was no, like, Pearl Harbor-like moment that encouraged these men and women to sign up. They just truly felt that Germany was in the wrong and that someone needed to stop them. And so it made it, I think, them much more noble in my own eyes than I'd really, I think, given them credit for beforehand.
You touch on something that was really kind of important to put it in context. Not only were we not in the war, most of us didn't want to go into the war. Pershing and people who were saying we need to do this were really in the minority, and you had a very, very public sentiment was against you.
No, absolutely. And also there was the political factor that the largest immigrant groups in America were the German Americans and the Irish Americans. So the German Americans certainly didn't want to go off and fight against their cousins or their siblings even, or, you know, even possibly their parents back in the fatherland. And the Irish were more than happy to see the British caught up in a major world war and wanted nothing to do with it. So right there, you have the two largest immigrant groups in America who really want nothing to do with this. And so kind of gradually, things started to change. You had the sinking of the Lusitania, where all these Americans died when the Germans torpedoed the ship. And then the key factor was what's called the Zimmermann Telegram. And it was a telegram, and it was a real document sent by Germany to Mexico saying, look, if you side with us and start, you know, trouble in the southern border, we'll try and have you recapture the lands that you lost in the Mexican-American War, like, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, and so forth. And so I think, you know, today people might think, well, we're not really at risk of being invaded by Mexico. But this is back when we actually had already been at war with Mexico. So this was conceived as a real threat. And Wilson was particularly infuriated. There's all this subterfuge behind the Zimmermann telegram itself, where the Germans actually went to the American embassy to send the telegram to Mexico. Now, obviously, it was coded. We couldn't read it, and they assured us that it was nothing, you know, major. But the Brits were actually intercepting our cables, and they didn't tell us this. So they came across it and had to figure out their own little plot to tell America how they discovered it without saying, we're kind of spying on you in the process. So I talk about the whole behind the scenes that's going on with all this. And again, to me, it almost reads like a spy novel. And there's also this incredible love story with Pershing and a woman he fell in love with after his wife died and so forth. So there were all these components that just made it such a human story, and it's not about these massive numbers of casualties that we always read about, or, you know, just the trench warfare, which of course I talk about, but it's really the human element, and to draw people into these characters and to these situations that are just inherently dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, you have people, you know, flying the early planes. You have people, as you said, driving ambulances. You have letters from folks who, were either in the trenches, were part of the campaign, whatever the campaign was going on at the time. One of the things that I think you also seem to touch on quite well in the book, although you're not talking about it explicitly, I don't think, is how so much changed because of the First World War. The way we think about diplomatic relations, certainly our army changed, and the way we thought about our military changed. And then there was all the art and the literature and the music that changed. And all of those things were kind of underneath what was going on.
Oh, absolutely. It was so revolutionary. I mean, here for the first time, you had, you know, in major use, submarines, tanks, gas, flamethrowers, machine guns, which really changed everything, and of course planes too. And so there was this novelty to all of it, and there was kind of a improvisational aspect to it as well, as troops were kind of getting used to these new forms of warfare. And so that in itself was fundamental, and it was something I really wanted to convey, especially with the pilots. I was really fascinated by these early combat aviators and what it was like, because these were very dangerous vehicles. I mean, they were up in the air, you know, the cockpits were open, they were freezing. They would have to, in the early days, change the machine guns by hand. So they'd have to stand up in the cockpit holding, you know, one hand on the throttle as they're taking out the drum and putting in the new machine bullets and so forth. And, it, you know, just all those little details made them come to life, and I think really demonstrated just the sacrifices they were making and what they were going through.
Well, also, there was one part where you talked about, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting which pilot it was, talking about the beauty of going through the clouds.
Yeah, so a lot of these young pilots, the Americans, were from Harvard and from Yale. They were studying in France and Paris mostly. And so they loved the country, and they were just horrified when it came under attack. And so first they volunteered for the French Foreign Legion, and they legally couldn't join the French army because America was technically neutral. But when you join the Foreign Legion, you don't give your loyalty to France, you give it to the Legion. Now, this is a distinction the Germans thought was pretty ridiculous, but it's nevertheless how the Americans got around that at the time. And then after the Foreign Legion, when this new aviation corps was being started, they called it the Lafayette Escadrille, after Lafayette, who, of course, was the Frenchman who came to America during the Revolution to help us win that conflict. And so, sort of in his honor, they named it the Lafayette Escadrille, and Escadrille was French for squadron. And just, you know, Victor in particular was this very artistic individual. And so he wrote back these really beautiful letters to his family about looking down, you know, thousands of feet up in the air, which was just, again, a totally novel experience for people. And just seeing the patchwork of the farmlands and the different colors and so forth, and how he loved kind of darting in between the clouds. And to think of how exhilarating that must have been back then for all of the discomforts they faced, again, like the freezing cold and everything that they were up against, it really gives you a sense of the rush of what they experienced and both their own sense of purpose, but also the dangers they faced.
Right, and a certain amount of infallibility which comes with youth.
Exactly. I mean, they really, in some ways, I mean, to some degree, they thought they were invincible, but they were also very aware of a kind of fatalism that, you know, if you were going to go, you were going to go. And there was really nothing you could do either way to stop it or to get through it. And Alan Seeger, who was mostly in the Foreign Legion, captured this, I think, the most powerfully in his poem, I Have a Rendezvous with Death. And I talk about Seeger's story and how it intersects with Chapman and so forth. And that, you know, I think what's overlooked is that the letters that these men and women were writing back at this time, as early as 1914 and 1915, were actually influencing the American public very subtly. But these letters were being shared. They were being published in newspapers. And I think it had some effect on the American psyche at that time.
Almost a, you know, a century-old version of social media, of somebody sending out a photo, and it in 1915 terms, it goes viral.
Absolutely. And people were writing one or two letters a day. I mean, it was very frequent. And so there was this sort of, I won't say barrage, but this constant messaging from the front lines, and they didn't really have to deal with censorship until the Americans came over officially. So what they wrote was very powerful and at times very graphic.
The other thing that you managed to capture in the book is the sense of, it's almost a disconnect between where the war was being fought and how close it wasn't being fought. So there was all of this stuff happening very close by that was not the trenches, not literally being shelled, not coming under fire. And it's almost kind of the last of the gentlemen's wars, if that makes sense.
No, it's funny you say that, because just going back to the pilots, I talked about in the early days, they actually didn't have weapons on the planes. They were used only for reconnaissance. So they would fly over, see where the enemy was based, and fly back and say, okay, they're over that hill or they're 2 miles away or wherever. And so when the pilots passed each other, the enemy pilots, they would almost wave and, you know, kind of give a jaunty hello to one another. And then, of course, when they start bringing weapons, things changed. But there was a bit of that old-fashioned sense of warfare. But once the machine guns came out and the gas was used and the flamethrowers, everything changed. And there was a real kind of hostility and a sense that, in fact, with the German soldiers who used flamethrowers, if they were ever captured by the French or the Americans, they were often just executed on the spot.
So this is, of course, before Geneva Convention rules.
Oh, yeah. And there actually were rules of international warfare that outlawed things like gas and so forth. But the Germans and then the French and the Americans, in retaliation, it all went out the window.
We just passed, on April 6th, the 100th anniversary of America joining the First World War. 100 years later, and you just went through this book and you've been thinking about this. What have we learned, and what can we learn from looking back at the First World War?
I think one of the greatest lessons that we should learn is how quickly events can spiral out of control. And this is not when America was involved, but when you look at the shooting of the Archduke, and I try and, you know, retell that scene very vividly, and then the repercussions it had. And what really struck me is that the Russians and the Germans, we kind of think of these in large geopolitical terms, but actually the Tsar and the Kaiser were first cousins. They had grown up together as little boys playing in their, you know, Queen Victoria's gardens in Buckingham Palace. And they were sending, in the early part before the war really exploded, these personal cables back and forth where they referred to each other as Nicky and Willie. And, you know, the Germans were more hell-bent on war than the Russians were. But you still see this kind of personal correspondence going on that makes it all, you know, not large and abstract, but very human. And that's one of the things I really want to convey, that, you know, nations are not these sort of grand entities that declare war, that it's individual human beings who do this, and that, like human beings, nations feel pride and humiliation, and they act rashly, or they act soberly, whatever the case may be. But to really put it in terms that I think we can all relate to, as opposed to, oh, we've got to read about, you know, the Russian government, the German government, and, you know, these millions of troops being amassed, it really does come down to the human element.
Well, I think you captured that beautifully.
Thank you.
Because, as you say, the book does read like a novel, but you know these things actually happened. And the influence that Pershing had on the generals of the Second World War. I mean, we would not have had MacArthur, and we would not have had Patton, and we would not have had Ike in the same way.
No, and actually, and Ike is a really fascinating aspect of this because he never set foot in France during the war. He was stateside the whole time. But after the war, he got to know Pershing, and Pershing was a bit of a mentor to him. And one of the little side stories that I never heard before that I came across and I mentioned is that Ike, as a young officer, was almost court-martialed because he accidentally misfiled some financial papers, and the army thought that they were trying to bilk the military out of money when it was just purely a clerical error. And so he was actually going to go to jail. And it was Pershing and another general, Fox Connor, who stepped in and saved Eisenhower again as a young officer. And just think, if Eisenhower had gone to prison, his military career would have been over. So he would not have gone on to become the Supreme Allied Commander in World War II. He would not have become president. So it's really interesting the effect that Pershing had on, you know, so many people like Patton and MacArthur who were over there and very much under fire. And one of my favorites was Bill Donovan. And he's known as kind of Wild Bill Donovan because he went off to found the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, in World War II. But in World War I, he was right there in the trenches getting shot at and shelled. And Truman is another example of this. He was an artillery officer, and he was on the front lines, and he was almost killed at several points. And so, you know, this war really influenced these characters who went off to have a huge and historic influence on world history.
Well, and Pershing ended up, you know, dying as an old man, but happy, because he ended up finally marrying the woman that he fell in love with in France.
Yeah, and I include some of his love letters to show that side of him. And what's really amazing about the relationship, it was a young, she was Romanian in, by birth, but she lived in Paris, and that's where they met during the war, was that she was very understanding of Pershing's continual love for his first wife. And there's even a letter written on the 10th anniversary of the fire where Pershing writes to Micheline, his new fiance, about, you know, the loss of Frankie, that was the name of his first wife, and the three girls, and how old they would have been at this point, and just that, you know, he still had never really gotten over the grief. And then there's a really beautiful letter he wrote to Micheline that he gave to his then-grown son, Warren, to give to her once Pershing passed away. And so when he died in 1948, this letter was given to her, and I obtained the original copy. And it's one of the most beautiful love letters I've ever read. And again, it just shows a different side of someone who, you know, almost seems more machine-like than man. He was so tough and rigid and not very personal. And he wasn't loved the way other generals were, but he really was an extraordinary individual. And he had real feelings for his troops. And it's one of the reasons why he was so tough is because he wanted them to return home alive. And he knew that that would be a better chance if they, you know, were very disciplined and hardworking and so forth. But, you know, again, my intention was to show the American troops, but also Pershing in a new light and why I think they really deserve to be remembered.
Well, the book is called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War, written by my guest, Andrew Carroll. Andy, it has been such a pleasure. Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Andrew Carroll is the founding director of the Center for American War Letters at Chapman University. His new book is called My Fellow Soldiers, General John Pershing and the Americans Who Helped Win the Great War. Carroll will be in Wisconsin this weekend for a Saturday afternoon event at the American Legion Post 449 in Brookfield. There's more information about his work at WUWM.com.